Thirsty? You've come to the right place to wet your whistle. It's the Liquid Lifestyle with Ryan McGarian, a full hour of liquid refreshment. Now, here's Ryan.
What's cracking, my thirsty listener? All right, so if the sound of my voice is flowing into your ears like a crisp and bracing shot of Norwegian akevit, you know that you're riding the earth with me here at the Liquid Lifestyle on the Radio Northwest Network. And as always, I am your host and on-air bartender, Ryan McGarian, where today, as we usually do, we're recording from the heart of my little cured ham and cocktail bar slash Oasis Hamlet here in Portland's Pearl District. And if you're joining us for the very first time, this little show of mine is generally dedicated to all things liquid and delicious. Specifically, we love talking spirits and cocktails and beers and wines, coffee and tea, with occasional forays into other spaces that I think you, my liquid listener, might enjoy, along with, of course, the fine folks and joints that serve all these bad boys up, be them right here in the city of roses, hops, and hipsters, or as you might have experienced in the past, parts far, far, far beyond. All right, so today I get to ride shotgun with one of P-Town's most talented, not to mention well-liked bartenders. He's also a fellow that continues to contribute widely to the greater intellectual space in our industry, and that's my man, Jacob Greer. Jacob, how the heavens are you this afternoon?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm over my jet lag from a trip to Iceland and glad to be back in Portland.
Dude, I mean, it's pretty cool that we have that that nonstop flight over to Iceland, man. I've been wanting to do it, but I bet that trip was just awesome. Dude, how cool was that?
It's definitely one of the best trips I've ever been on. Amazing trip. Got to hike into a glacier, drink aquavit and beer in a hot tub, see the northern lights. Life doesn't get too much better than that.
Dude, I would say that sounds just about right, but I actually want to talk more about that trip to Iceland a little bit later on in the show, but again, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. There's so much to talk about with regards to your career and your success in the beverage space. But as I like to do with most of my guests, take us back, man. I mean, where'd you grow up? And, you know, how did you get into the world of professional beverage in general, my man?
It was a pretty roundabout trip. It wasn't where I expected to end up necessarily. I grew up in Spring, Texas, which is straight up I-45 north of Houston. So it used to be a pretty small suburb. Now it's getting a lot more crowded, a lot bigger. So I spent my time there, and then I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville, which would be where I first started drinking ever so slightly, a little bit of wine at the philosophy major seminars. And then I moved on from there to Washington, D.C., which is where I first started really getting into the beverage industry.
And as I recall from past conversations, you didn't jump right into being this guru of beer cocktails and being a world-class craft bartender. You started with an interesting coffee. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that was my first job in the beverage industry. I moved to D.C. thinking I wanted to work in public policy. Turns out, not cut out for the office life. So after a couple internships that just weren't working for me, I ended up going to a coffee shop. And it was kind of a weird story. I went to my favorite coffee shop, which was never a fancy place. And I met with the owner, dropped off a job application, didn't hear from him for a while. And then I went back home to Houston for vacation. And I came back and I talked to him, asked him what happened. And for some reason, he had no reason that he had to do this. He took me aside and said, "Actually, I've sold the shop. It's closing, but there's a new guy coming in to open this great coffee shop, so you should go talk to him." And that was Nick Cho, who, if you follow the coffee world, he's a really famous guy in the American coffee business. He opened a place called Murky Coffee in D.C., which is where I worked. And now he's at Wrecking Ball, which is a great roaster in kind of the Bay Area now.
So this puts you at about age, what is that, about age 22, 23?
Yeah, 22. And that was my first coffee job, and that was completely eye-opening experience. The training that Nick did on our first day was such a great way to train people. Especially ones who weren't really coffee geeks yet, because that culture didn't really exist in D.C. So he took the group of the new hires, he handed us $20 from his wallet, told us to go to Starbucks and buy whatever we would normally get at Starbucks and to bring it back. And then he asked us what each of us ordered, and then he made it his way. And so I got, you know, some kind of latte at Starbucks and then out of a paper cup. And then he came in and he poured this perfect latte art with perfectly silky smooth foam, and completely changed my perspective on drinks and got me interested in mastering a craft, and for the next year, did a lot of cupping, did a lot of pulling shots on their espresso machine, and just, you know, really geeked out the way people like us do when we get into something like that.
So cool to hear. Man, this is just an ongoing narrative in our industry right now. The movement of baristas, or people trained as world-class baristas, moving into the spirit and cocktail sector. So many people here in Portland have done that. I mean, Tyler Stevens very specifically comes to mind, you know, an outstanding barista at Barista, and then moving on within only a couple years to be the bar manager at Teardrop. Quite an amazing story there. But so you become captivated with precision and balance and quality in the coffee space. How did you, where was your first, when did you first start to move towards spirits and cocktails professionally?
Well, we didn't have a whole lot of it going on in DC at the time. It was a little bit, but I was out of touch with it. I got into beer first, had some really memorable long nights at Belgian beer bars in DC. And then I was trying to figure out what to do next, and my options were probably either open a coffee shop, get into roasting, or find something new. And so I thought, well, let's try something new, and I decided to try bartending. And so luckily, one of the places where I'd been a barista also had a pretty basic bar. And so they let me learn the ropes by reading Gary Regan's Joy of Mixology and working the Monday day shifts. So I made, you know, on a good day, I might make three cocktails, but it was a way to get started.
And that's how you get started, man. You just got to get your foot in the door, and you got to be stoked about it just like you've always been. Once again, we're chatting with Jacob Greer, a super well-respected, just an awesome dude all around here in P-Town. He's the author of a recently released book about beer cocktails, which we're going to get to in a bit. So you get that bartending gig, you know, you're making only a couple drinks. Let's stop for a second there. Gary Regan's Joy Mixology, that's had a profound effect, I know, on myself, on a lot of bartenders of this generation. Do you remember having it have a pretty profound effect on you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially the parts in the book where he talked about the families of drinks and how it's not just a bunch of random recipes that you have to memorize. It's actually a pretty fairly standard number of templates that once you can wrap your head around that, you can get creative and try new things.
He was, I think, the first person to really put template form into a book, and I remember really appreciating that, particularly about that that tome of his. What a good dude! But all right, so you got that gig. What's next? Do you stay in D.C. for a while? When do you make the jump to P-Town, man?
Yeah, I actually stayed in D.C. for a little bit more than a year, and mainly because I felt like I wasn't really getting the bartending thing. Like it didn't, the level I was doing it at the time didn't have the same level of craft as coffee did, so I got bored. And I actually took a job in a think tank, and I committed for a year. But before I took the job, I took a vacation into San Francisco, and I went to a few bars there, including Rye. And that just blew my mind. And sitting at Rye and talking to the bartender there and having his drinks was this eureka moment when I realized, this is what bartending should be, this is what I should be doing. But I had a year to spend in D.C. before I did that. So I put in my year at the think tank, which was fun, and I enjoyed it. But then I was ready to go, and I just drove out west for about 2 months. And Portland was on my radar as sort of the default destination. But though I was open to stopping in other places, almost stayed in Denver. But Portland was the lure. So after going all the way down to, went up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, down to Denver and Los Angeles, then back up the coast to Portland.
Man, you really did it. I gotta ask, what was that think tank all about, man? I mean, you gotta throw that out, the word think tank. One's gotta know what that's all about.
It's a pretty strange life. I hope somebody makes a good TV show about the DC think tank life. But yeah, it was nine to five at a desk in a suit, but you know, you're surrounded by smart people. You get to work with ideas all day. It's a really cool environment.
Wow, surrounded by smart people. I like that as a name for a cocktail. So, do you remember the year you moved to Portland in?
Yeah, it was late 2008.
Okay, so right kind of, man, that's really when the kind of cocktail renaissance is really building up steam around the country. I remember I always use Tales of the Cocktail as a reference point. You know, that's really when I remember, you know, going down and it going from like hundreds of people to thousands of people. Once again, we're speaking with Jacob Greer, one of Portland's most respected and talented bartenders here on the Liquid Lifestyle. Hope you're enjoying your Saturday. We're coming to the end of the first round, and we're gonna bow out right here, and we'll be back at you for a second round in just a second. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network. Hope you're enjoying a fine P-Town Saturday afternoon. It's March, moving towards the good weather. Pretty stoked about that. And if you missed the first segment, we are hanging out with Jacob Greer, one of Portland's most respected and talented barmen. Also the author of a book about beer cocktails, which we're going to talk about. And in the last segment, we got to talk all about his kind of genesis, where Jacob started, like a lot of craft bartenders these days, finding passion in coffee and learning how to be a great barista. And I tell you what, learning how to manage the precision that it takes to make great coffee drinks is just such a good way to kind of prep yourself for the rigorous kind of precision needed to make excellent cocktails in volume environments, and also, I guess, as a consultant and when you do it from a recipe development perspective. But so towards the end, we talked about you getting into P-Town, and so that's 2008. And what was your first gig when you arrived here?
Well, I was open to either bartending or being a barista, but I didn't have enough tattoos to be a barista in Portland. I have none. So the first place I ended up was the Carlisle, which is not around anymore, but it was a really good high-end restaurant with this dark, cozy New York-style bar. And that was run by Neil Copeland, who was one of the original Oregon Bartenders Guild guys, who now does vermouth, the Imbue vermouths. And I was also good friends with Lance Mayhew from the original OBG, who also introduced me to everyone in town. And so Carlisle's where I ended up first.
Man, I remember, well, I've known Neil for a long time. We're buds. He's been on the show. Neil has been, just like yourself, a great contributor to the intellectual space, specifically Neil with Imbue Vermouth, which is just fantastic. And like I said, we talked all about that in a past episode. But I remember the Carlisle being just such a great room. It was a hidden gem. And for those who don't remember or know about the Carlisle, if you know where the Olympia Provisions is in Northwest on, I think on Thurman, it was basically that space before. So, man, I bet that was a really fun gig. And I bet you probably learned a lot working with Neil.
I learned a ton from Neil. Neil is such a great guy and took me under his wing, taught me a lot. It was fun working with Neil too, because I had this kind of sheltered cocktail environment, because I really just had to make drinks for myself most of the time. So I was geeking out on things like Aviations and Martinez's and all these old classic cocktails. And then somebody would come in, and I remember one night somebody ordered a lemon drop. And I had to say, Neil, how do you make a lemon drop? Because I hadn't made a lemon drop in a very, very long time.
And I tell you what, like 2008, a place like that, I mean, we were kind of moving out of that lemon drop era, so it would have been just, it's even amazing to me, you know, I've bartended for 20 years, and, you know, I remember the 90s and 2000s when it was, lemon drop was every other order, you know, and it's really like, you know, when I watch the tickets come up at Hamlet and Oven and Shaker, like, you know, we only see lemon drops come up maybe one or two times on a busy night. It's kind of crazy how far we've moved down kind of the intellectual path with regards to cocktails, and man, I just remember really, really enjoying that place. So I remember at the same time, that was when I first met you and heard about you, and I also remember you had a blog. Tell me about that blog.
Yeah, I've been blogging since 2003, which definitely makes me an old man in blog years. So it's almost 15 years now. And it started out as just whatever I wanted to write about. So it was usually politics back in the early days, and then it got into coffee, and then it became sort of a cocktail blog. And at that time, this was such a great way to get into the industry, because blogs had a lot more cachet than they do now. Now everybody posts on Facebook and Twitter, and it's a lot more egalitarian. Anybody can do it. But back then, you know, having a blog was a really good way to stand out, and it was a great way to promote your bar. So even though I was pretty new in the industry, it helped me get a big step up, you know, the fact that I could post recipes and get people involved. And plus, back then, it was just a lot easier to find new things to write about, because the base level we were starting from was so much lower than it is today. Just a simple post on just what Campari is, you know, could probably get a lot of traffic, whereas now, you know, that's considered so basic. You have to dig really deep to find something that nobody's written about anymore.
Well, when I think about blogs, of course, I think about your blog. I think about Jeffrey's blog, Jeffrey Morgenthaler, and just that's been one of the keys to the success of so many bartenders in this age is the ability to communicate. That's one thing I think you do really well. I think you communicate so clearly. You have a really even disposition. You're always optimistic, and you're super intellectual. Well, this is all really, really good combo. Once again, we're talking with Jacob Greer, who is the one of Portland's favorite sons from afar. Super talented bartender and the author of it's called Beer Cocktails, right?
It's called Cocktails on Tap, but I wish we'd called it Beer Cocktails because now everybody thinks it's a book about putting cocktails in kegs, which I've never actually done in my life. I get job offers now to consult on that, and I have to tell them I have no idea what I'm doing.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to get to that in a little bit, but I you know, part of I guess the passion I have, one of the great passions I have for this show, of course, is telling stories, and I want to make sure that while we have you here, we really get your story dialed in. So you're at the Carlisle. That's really, I think, where you're making your bones as a craft bartender. What was your next restaurant gig? It seems like, was it Metrovino?
Yeah, I had a bit of a gap period, but Metrovino was the next place I went to. And I didn't know if I'd be bartending again because I'd been doing some other work in the industry. And then the owner convinced me to do it. It was such a good place. And I didn't have the time to do it full time, but he let me do it part time. And it ended up being just such a great fit because if anybody went there, you know, we had about 80 different wines available with this fancy wine pouring system, which was a huge pain to deal with on my end, but it was great for customers. And it gave us the freedom to do some really creative drinks along with some amazing food that kitchen was putting out. It's a top-notch food restaurant.
Dude, and that was Greg and Gabby, right?
Yeah, who've now moved on to Open Ox, which is phenomenal.
And for those who don't know, they're also opening, Greg and Gabby are opening Superbite, where Gruner used to be, over on the corner of Northwest, Southwest 12th and Alder. And I think my business partner, Kurt, today told me that they're looking at mid-April on that. So Superbite, man, that's going to be something to look forward to. So tell us a little bit about the cocktail menu that you put together. And you put that together, right? I mean, this was kind of your first kind of cocktail culture that you've created, correct?
Well, I got to do a little bit of that at Carlisle towards the end there. But yeah, Metrovino was really the first place where I came in and got to really just do a menu from scratch. And so we were pretty adventurous. You know, it was a challenging bar to work with. We didn't have a standard speed rail or any of that kind of stuff. We literally had the bottles behind the Riedel glassware. So you had to be slow and gentle when you're handling things. But we got to do some fun techniques like lime juice clarification that Dave Arnold did in New York. And we were operating at a low enough volume on the cocktail side that we could have fun with things like that.
Yeah, I remember, I remember popping in there and yeah, the food was awesome. And the work you were doing was great. And you could have a great glass of wine. You could have a great cocktail. It was all good. But we're at the end of round two, folks. Hope you're enjoying this conversation that we're having with Jacob Greer. We'll be right back at you in just a moment. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network, where we're in a really cool conversation with Jacob Greer, one of Portland's most respected bartenders and the author of Cocktails on Tap. And man, he's done so much, man. The last few rounds, we've been kind of just tracing Jacob's background, you know, starting like so many great bartenders do these days in coffee and learning the precision, you know, in that space, and then moving from doing coffee in D.C. To working at the Carlisle here in Portland with our friend Neil Copeland, and then moving on to run the bar program over at Metrovino, working with Greg Denton and Gabby Quinones over there. So really good pedigree early on for you, man. But you know, I want to move on because there's obviously a lot more to talk about. The next thing I think that comes to mind when it's when the name Jacob Greer comes up is just how professional you've been when it comes to you know, being a really good ambassador for some really cool brands. And you've worked with a lot of really high quality brands over the last 5-6 years, haven't you?
I've been really lucky to work with some cool brands, starting with Bowles Geneva, which was the first one that sort of fell into my lap. They did their launch party for Oregon at the Carlisle back before we closed. And then a few months later, they just called me up out of the blue and said, hey, we're thinking about hiring a brand ambassador in Portland and wanted to know if you'd be interested in something like that. And loving Geneva and being unemployed at the time, I said, yes, I would be very interested in that.
So I want to jump in real quick. Most of our, I think most imbibers in this country have no idea what Geneva, Yenever, whatever you want to call it, is. Can you give us just a short, quick, off-the-cuff tutorial on what the heck that bad, this delicious juice from Holland is?
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I love that job, is I love working with things that people don't know yet. And Geneva definitely fits that bill. So historically, it's the predecessor to gin. But I think gin is kind of a confusing way to think about it, because if you call it a gin, then somebody's going to go make a gin and tonic with it or a martini with it, and that doesn't really work, as you know. So the way Geneva's made, contrary to gin, which is usually made with neutral spirits, Geneva's almost more like a whiskey base. It's very malty, very grainy, and in fact, if you left out one step, you'd basically have whiskey. So you start with that grain base, which they call Maltwein in Dutch, and then you add another distillation where you bring in juniper and other botanicals. But it can be much, much less botanical than most gins. And some of them you might not even know at all. You just think this is a weird whiskey if you try it, because they can be aged for up to a decade or more. I've got a 10-year-old one at home. So it's fun introducing people to that and giving them Geneva in, a Kopstutje, which is the little headbutt, the shot in the beer, or a stirred cocktail that's maybe more like a whiskey drink. So it was a really fun, challenging job getting to work with a very traditional, historic product like that and bring it into the United States, where people haven't really done much with it, and, you know, really since Jerry Thomas's time back in the 1800s.
Yeah, what a lot of people probably don't also know is when you look at gin in cocktail books from the late 19th century, what they're actually generally referring to is not anything like the dry gin that we enjoy today, but this malty, rich, characterful spirit that you're talking about. Do you have a favorite? You know, I mean, say somebody goes, they go to the store, they pick up a bottle of Bull's, is it 1840? Is that what it is? Bull's 1840? What's a simple thing someone listening to this show could do with some Yenever?
You know, one of the first drinks that I got really excited about with it was Evan Zimmerman, back when he was at Laurelhurst Market, turned me onto the Holland Razor Blade, which is a Charles Baker drink. And it's just a Geneva sour, so Geneva, lemon juice, simple syrup, shaken, served up. But then you sprinkle a little cayenne pepper on top to give it that little spicy burn on your lips. And that's a really fun cocktail.
I'm glad you brought that up. I remember seeing that actually at the Varnish a while back. It's really, yeah, it's been one of those drinks that's popped up. I'm so glad I know that I now know that it comes from Charles Baker. I guess I thought that might be a modern drink, but it's not. So it's that's one of the great things about having this show is all the little knickknacks that selfishly I get to enjoy learning as we go along. So you do some time with Bull's. You know, I know you've also worked with El Dorado Rum, and you're still doing work with Novo Fogo Cachaça, correct?
Yeah, and that's the same kind of situation as with Bull's, where you've got a really great product that people in the U.S. probably don't know much about. If they have had cachaça, they've probably had what we call the industrial cachaças, which they're either distilled to such a high proof that they might as well be vodka, or they're super rough, you know, jet fuel that you don't want to drink, and so all you can do is cover it up in a caipirinha, which is, you know, cachaça, lime, sugar. And Drago Sextinte up in Seattle started Novo Fogo. Completely blew my mind the first time I tried his cachaça. It's incredibly grassy and aromatic. And he sent me a bottle, and I was a little skeptical at first because there's so many cachaças on the market. But on that one, literally as soon as I popped the cork, I was just hit with these aromas of sugar cane and grass and fresh bananas, and it completely changed my perspective on it. And so I've had a great time working with Novo Fogo, and they're a lot of fun in the industry for various reasons. They sponsor a soccer tournament here at Portland Cocktail Week every year. And they're introducing cachaça in a way that nobody else has in the United States, with barrel aging and different barrel finishes and just incredibly high quality juice.
Yeah, I can second that, man. We've got Novo Fogo behind both my bars, both Oven and Shaker and Hamlet. And it's a really incredible, clean, funky expression of that spirit category. Man, I'm just going to tap into some more of your intellect. Can you just give us a quick tutorial on cachaça real quick, bud?
Yeah, I mean, there's basically two big differences between cachaça and rum. One is it's got to be made in Brazil. That's the easy one. Second one is it has to be made from sugarcane juice. So no molasses, no other byproducts, just fresh sugarcane. That said, there's a huge range of quality that you can get into from that. Like we said, it gets industrial at the low end, or, you know, what we do, which is organic and very fresh juice and distilled just one time in a copper pot still, so you get something very aromatic and fresh tasting.
Dude, once again, we're talking with Jacob Greer, Portland barman extraordinaire, also the author of Cocktails on Tap, and we better move on to that book here pretty soon. In fact, let's do it right now. So you've had some great exposure working in great cocktail bars like the Carlisle Metrovino. Then you jumped into becoming a really well-respected brand ambassador, and then you write this freaking book about beer cocktails, man. When did you get into beer cocktails?
You know, I've always been into beer. And I've got to give credit to Ezra Johnson Greenow, who's the writer of the New School Beer Blog here in town, and he organizes Portland Beer Week and a bunch of other events. And he had the foresight back in 2009 or so to see that beer cocktails were becoming a big trend. And so he recruited me, and he recruited Yetta Verobic, who's the owner of the Hop and Vine, to come together and create this event called Brewing Up Cocktails, where we just started experimenting with using beer as a cocktail ingredient, and we ended up doing, I want to say, 5 or 6 different events here in Portland, plus up in Vancouver, down in New Orleans, the Tales of the Cocktail. So we really got to explore beer as a cocktail ingredient in all kinds of weird ways.
Yeah, I would say that since you got involved with beer cocktails, Jacob, I've seen it become I've seen it really just jump in popularity all over the city and all over the country. So when do you start thinking about writing a freaking book, dude?
Honestly, at least 3 years before it got published, because it was a long uphill battle to get that done. You know, we had to write a proposal, which took a long time. I couldn't get a publisher. I couldn't get an agent. I tried to do a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter failed. So it was a pretty long road. And then I finally got an agent. And as soon as I got an agent, everything fell into place. And he found Abrams, Stuart Taborian Chang, which has just been a superb publisher to work with. They make beautiful books. And they didn't try to dumb anything down. They really let me go crazy with it. Even when I changed the plan and said, let's do a whole chapter on hot beer drinks, which is super weird, they were into it. And so we got to do something really cool.
Speaking of that, were you just in the Wall Street Journal recently with like hot beer drinks or something like that?
Yeah, this is something I've been trying to push for the past year, is bringing back these old school beer drinks, which sounds really weird because nobody wants a hot IPA or a hot lager. But if you think about like a really malty English ale or a Belgian quad, especially the English ales, this was how they did it back in the 16, 17, 1800s. Yeah, just like you would a cider today or make a wassail. Just get some nice malty beer, add some spirits, some sugar, some spices. It can work really surprisingly good as a hot drink.
Yeah, no doubt. Once again, we're talking with Jacob Greer, Portland bartender, author of Cocktails on Tap. How long did it take you to write that tome, man?
Well, I had a lot of research done in advance and some writing done for the proposal, but once I signed the contract, I had about 3.5 months to write the entire book and do all the photography with David Lanthan Reber, plus then revisions down the line. But it was a pretty intense process once that contract was signed of basically doing nothing else.
Do you have a favorite? So somebody goes and they pick up this book. Is there a page they should turn to right away? Is there a beer cocktail that you just think is the ultimate beer cocktail?
I don't know if I'd say the ultimate, but I will say the one that I serve at almost every event I do is the Mai Tai PA. And this is one of the ideas I like doing, is taking a tiki cocktail, which usually doesn't have much bitterness to it.
Sorry, I got to jump in real quick. Jacob, we are at the end of round 3. We will pick up where we left off in our final round. Back at you in just a moment, folks. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle, where I hope you're just enjoying a very peaceful Saturday afternoon. And once again, we're coming at you from my little ham and cocktail oasis hamlet in the Pearl District, where we're once again riding shotgun with Jacob Greer, one of Portland's favorite bartenders, who's had a lot of success just in the industry as a whole. And he's the author of Cocktails on Tap, which we were talking about in the last segment. And man, we wrapped up talking. I asked you what your favorite beer cocktail was, and what did you say, the Mai Tai PA?
Yeah, it's a really fun one, and it's just a classic Mai Tai. So rum, orgeat, which is an almond syrup, lime juice, a little bit of orange liqueur, but then take a really floral, hoppy IPA, like, say, Breakside's here in town, and just shake about 1.5 ounces of that into the classic recipe. So you end up with this this nice frothy head on the drink and also this little touch of bitterness. And it's one of those things that sounds really weird, but then people try it and they're hooked.
Dude, well, I guess that's going to be the whole thing when it comes to beer cocktails, is it's probably going to sound weird up in the beginning, no matter what it is, but it's easy to get hooked on them. And I know that you've been an inspiration for me. We do quite a few beer cocktails next door to Oven. I know we've got the Nap for Sasquatch, which is the Diablo Rojo with a little chinar and grapefruit and maple and some soda and bitters. And we've got the Pilsner versus Aperol. And I gotta say, man, if it wasn't for you, who knows whether those things would have been created in the first place. So, yeah, how cool, man. You've added a lot to the intellectual space. Well done, dude. But, man, there's still a lot more to talk about. You've done a lot of stuff. Tell us about Akavit Week. I think that's something you fathered, huh?
Yeah, that's an event I started 4 years ago at Metro Vino. And it was when I just started getting really interested in Akavit, which, as you well know, Krogstad from House Spirits here in Portland was a pioneer and introduced a lot of bartenders to the spirit. And there's just a few American distillers who started picking it up early, like none as early as House Spirits, but then there was one called North Shore in Chicago, and then right after that, one called Gamelode up in Minnesota. And I just happened to be traveling and managed to pick up all these bottles. And then I realized, wow, Akavit is this amazingly diverse spirit. And if you compared them, you know, Krogstad is very anise forward, and Gamelode up in Minnesota was dill aquavit, and the North Shore tasted like cumin. There's all these different flavors you could play with, which, and of course caraway, which is almost always the primary ingredient in all of these. So this was our way of showcasing aquavit and trying. We got every one we could buy in the United States at that time and made a cocktail with each one. And now there's more than 30 aquavits, so that would be a crazy event to try to do now.
And once again, we're going to tap into your intellect because, you know, a lot of the stuff that you get involved with is pretty heady, you know. So, you know, a lot of the people listening today may or may not have ever heard of or have had Akavit. And just to give a little background, Akavit essentially means water of life in the same way that eau de vie does, or Usca Beja, referring to whiskey in the Gaelic language. Tell us just a quick tutorial on Akavit, man.
It's a pretty loose spirit. You can do a lot with it. It's pretty much always made from a fairly neutral base, usually either grain or potatoes. And then it's flavored. In Europe, it's either caraway or dill. In the United States, right now, the law says it just has to be caraway. But beyond that, you can do pretty much anything you want. Add any botanicals to it. Age it however you want. So there's some, you know, that are pure caraway and totally unaged. Others are incredibly complex. Like Linja from Norway is aged on ships. They put it into sherry cask and it literally travels from Norway down to Australia and back. So you can do lots of cool stuff. It's a hugely diverse spirit. And so when you're making cocktails with it, you know, depending on what kind of cocktail you want to make, what botanicals you want to feature, you can find a different aquavit to use.
So true, man. I always like to kind of describe aquavit to people as kind of like the gin of Scandinavia. Of course, gin is built around juniper, where, once again, like you said, aquavit is built around caraway and really any alternative botanical that you might like to use, commonly dill, like you said, and also star anise. And I'm glad you brought up Linja. You know, I think that means line, meaning it crosses the line or the equator twice before it's is put in a bottle. So I think that's pretty cool. What are some of your favorite aquavit applications when it comes to mixing drinks?
Well, I like it straight out of the freezer more than anything, but Negroni-type drinks are fantastic. You know, Kevin Ludwig, who's now at Laurel Horse Market, makes a great Krogstad Negroni. There was the Trident, which is kind of a Negroni variation from Robert Hess. I love doing Collins-style cocktails. Played a little bit with Old Fashions. Over at the Whiskey Library, where I work sometimes, one of our bartenders made an awesome aquavit and scotch cocktail with a little nocino. Kind of nuttiness can play well with those notes. So it's incredibly versatile if you just pick the right aquavit for the right application.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I find myself just playing Mr. Potato Head a lot, swapping in aquavit in gin and vodka cocktails, even light rum. How about yourself? You ever do that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was actually playing around last night with some martini variations, trying to dial them in with different aquavits and desperate type stuff.
Dude, we're at the end, man. This flew by. Folks, it's been so good talking to Jacob Greer. We hope you have a fantastic Saturday evening. We are getting out of here. See you next week.